Welcome to the Hackberry House of Chosun. My name is Bob, and I'm reading today from the Free Grace Broadcaster. The Free Grace Broadcaster is a quarterly that will be sent to your home if you just write to them, chapel@mountzion.org. Give them an email, let them know that you're interested in receiving this quarterly every 3 months, and it'll come to your door, and you'll be able to read great men of God from the past on a particular topic. This topic, this time around, a little different, church and state. It's biblical. Romans 13:1, the powers that be are ordained of God. And this is the final one in this series, the winter series of 2021. And it's by Samuel Davies. It's called The Kingdom of Christ. Now, who was Samuel Davies? You may not know that name. I did not. Samuel Davies was a Presbyterian minister, lived in 1723 to 1761, and actually an American. We don't have too many, it seems, that come up in our native soil that are true and great men of God. We have some, but not as many. He's from Delaware. Samuel Davies, The Kingdom of Christ. Kings and kingdoms are the most majestic sounds in the language of mortals. They've filled the world with noise, confusions, and blood since mankind first left the state of nature and formed themselves into societies. The disputes of kingdoms for superiority have set the world in arms from age to age and destroyed or enslaved a considerable part of the human race. And the contest is not yet decided. Our country has been a region of peace and tranquility for a long time. This is written in the 1700s, understand. But it has not been because the lust of power and riches is extinct in the world, but because we had no near neighbors whose interest might clash with ours or who were able to disturb us. The absence of an enemy was our sole defense. But now, when the colonies of the sundry European nations on this continent begin to enlarge and approach towards each other, the scene is changed. Now encroachments, depredations, barbarities, and all the terrors of war begin to surround and alarm us. Now our country is invaded and ravaged and bleeds in a thousand veins. We have already, and this was preached in 1756, so early in the year, received alarm upon alarm, and we may expect the alarms to grow louder and louder as the season advances. These commotions and perturbations have had one good effect upon me, and that is, they've carried away my thoughts of late into a serene and peaceful region, a region beyond the reach of confusion and violence. I mean the kingdom of the Prince of Peace. And there, my brethren, I would also transport your minds this day as the best refuge from this boisterous world and the most agreeable mansion for the lovers of peace and tranquility. I find it advantageous both to you and me to entertain you with those subjects that have made the deepest impression upon my own mind. That's the reason I choose the present subject. In my text, you hear one entering a claim to a kingdom, whom you would conclude, if you regarded only his outward appearance, to be the meanest and vilest of mankind, meanest meaning lowliest here. To hear a powerful prince at the head of a victorious army, attended with all the royalties of his character, to hear such a one claim the kingdom he had acquired by force of arms would not be strange. But here, the despised Nazarene, rejected by his nation, forsaken by his followers, accused as the worst of criminals, standing defenseless at Pilate's bar, about to be condemned and hung on a cross like a criminal and a slave. Here he speaks in a royal style, even to his judge. Thou sayest that I am a king. To this end was I born, and for this cause came I into the world, that I should bear witness unto the truth. That's John 18:37. Strange language indeed to proceed from his lips in these circumstances, but the truth is, a great A divine person is concealed under this disguise, and his kingdom is of such a nature that his abasement and crucifixion were so far from being a hindrance to it that they were the only way to acquire it. These sufferings were meritorious, and by these he purchased his subjects and a right to rule them. It is the mediatorial kingdom of Christ that is here intended, not that which, as God, he exercises over all the works of his hands. It is that kingdom which is an empire of grace, an administration of mercy over our guilty world. It is the dispensation intended for the salvation of fallen sinners of our race by the gospel. And on this account, the gospel is often called the kingdom of heaven, because its happy consequences are not confined to this earth, but appear in heaven in the highest perfection and last through all eternity. Hence, not only the church of Christ on earth and the dispensation of the gospel, but all the saints in heaven and that more finished economy under which they are placed are all included in the kingdom of Christ. Here his kingdom is in its infancy, but in heaven it will be perfection. But it is substantially the same. Though the immediate design of this kingdom is the salvation of believers of the guilty race of man, and such are its subjects in a peculiar sense, yet it extends to all worlds, to heaven and earth and hell. The whole universe is put under a mediatorial head. But then, as the apostle observed, he is made head over all things to the church, Ephesians 1:22. That is, for the benefit and salvation of his church. As mediator, he is carrying on a glorious scheme for the recovery of man, and all parts of the universe are interested or concern themselves in this grand event. Therefore, they are all subjected to him that he may so manage them as to promote this end and baffle and overwhelm all opposition. Christ, as a mediator, is made the head of all the heavenly armies, and he employs them as his ministering spirits to minister to them that are heirs of salvation, Hebrews 1:14. These glorious creatures are always on the wing, ready to discharge his orders in any part of his vast empire, and delight to be employed in the services of his mediatorial kingdom. This is also an event in which the fallen angels deeply interest themselves. They have united all their force and art for nearly 6,000 years to disturb and subvert his kingdom and to blast the designs of redeeming love. Therefore, they are all subjected to the control of Christ, and he shortens and lengthens their chains as he pleases. They cannot go a hair's breadth beyond his permission. The scriptures represent our world in its state of guilt and misery as the kingdom of Satan. Sinners, while slave to sin, are his subjects, and every act of disobedience against God is an act of homage to this infernal prince. Hence, Satan is called the god of this world, the prince of this world, the power of darkness, the prince of the power of the air, the spirit that now worketh in the children of disobedience. And sinners are said to be taken captive by him at his will. Hence also the ministers of Christ, who are employed to recover sinners to a state of holiness and happiness, are represented as soldiers armed for war, not indeed with carnal weapons, but with those that are spiritual, plain truth arguments and miracles. These are made mighty through God to the pulling down of strongholds, casting down imaginations, and every high thing that exalteth itself against the knowledge of God, and bringing into captivity every thought to the obedience of Christ. And Christians in general are represented as wrestling not with flesh and blood, but against principalities, against powers, against the rulers of the darkness of this world, against spiritual wickedness in high places. Hence also, the death of Christ is represented not as a defeat, but as an illustrious conquest gained over the powers of hell, because by this means a way was opened for the deliverance of sinners from under their power and restoring them into liberty and the favor of God. By that strange, contemptible weapon, the cross, And by the glorious resurrection of Jesus, he spoiled principalities and powers and made a show of them openly, triumphing over them. Through death, says the apostle, he destroyed him that had the power of death, that is, the devil. Had not Christ, by his death, offered a propitiatory sacrifice for the sins of men, they would have continued forever under the tyranny of Satan. But he has purchased liberty, life, and salvation for them. Thus he hath destroyed the kingdom of darkness and translated multitudes from it into his own gracious and glorious kingdom. Hence, upon the right of redemption, his mediatorial authority tends to the infernal regions, and he controls and restrains those malignant, mighty, and turbulent potentates according to his pleasure. Farther, the inanimate world is connected with our Lord's design to save sinners, and is therefore subjected to him as mediator. He causes the sun to rise, the rain to fall, and the earth to yield her increase to furnish provision for the subjects of his grace, and to raise, support, and accommodate heirs for his heavenly kingdom. As for the sons of men who are more immediately concerned in this kingdom and for whose sake it was erected, they are all its subjects. But then they are of different sorts according to their characters. Multitudes are rebels against his government, that is, they do not voluntarily submit to his authority, nor do they choose his service. They will not obey his laws, but they are his subjects notwithstanding. That is, he rules and manages them as he pleases, whether they will or not. This power is necessary to carry on successfully his gracious design towards his people, for unless he had the management of his enemies, they might baffle his undertaking and successfully counteract the purposes of his love. The kings of the earth, as well as vulgar rebels of a private character, have often set themselves against his kingdom. Sometimes they have flattered themselves that they had demolished it. But Jesus reigns absolute and supreme over the kings of the earth and overrules and controls them as he thinks proper. He disposes all the revolutions, the rises and falls of kingdoms and empires, to be subservient to the great designs of his mediation. Their united policies and powers cannot frustrate the work that he has undertaken. But besides these rebellious, involuntary subjects, he has, and blessed be his name, gained the consent of thousands, and they have become his willing subjects by their own choice. They regard his authority, they love his government, they make it their study to please him and to do his will. Over these he exercises a government of special grace here, and he will make them the happy subjects of the kingdom of his glory hereafter. And it is his government over these that I intend more particularly to consider. Once more, the kingdom of Jesus is not confined to this world, but the millions of mankind in the invisible world are under his dominion and will continue to be so to everlasting ages. He is the Lord both of the dead and the living. He has the keys of Hades, the vast invisible world, including heaven as well as hell, and of death. He turns the key and opens the door of death for mortals to pass from world to world. He opens the gates of heaven and welcomes and admits the nations that keep the commandments of God, and he opens the prison of hell and locks it fast upon the prisoners of divine justice. He will forever exercise authority over the vast regions of the unseen world and the unnumbered multitudes of spirits with which they are peopled. Hence, you see, my brethren, the universal extent of the Redeemer's kingdom. In this respect, how much does it differ from all the kingdoms of the earth? The kingdoms of Great Britain, France, China, Persia are but little spots of the globe. Our world has indeed been oppressed in former times with what mortals call universal monarchies. Such were the Babylonians, the Persian, the Grecian, especially the Roman. But in truth, these were so far from being strictly universal that a considerable part of the habitable earth was not so much as known to them. But this is an empire strictly universal. It extends over land and sea. It reaches beyond the planetary worlds and all the luminaries of heaven, nay, beyond the throne of the most exalted archangels and downward to the lowest abyss in hell. A universal empire in the hands of a mortal is a huge, unwieldy thing, a heap of confusion, a burden to mankind. And it is always rushed headlong from its glory and fallen to pieces by its own weight. But Jesus is equal to the immense province of an empire strictly universal. His hand can hold the reins, and it is the blessing of our world to be under his administration. He will turn what appears to us scenes of confusion into perfect order, and convince all worlds that he has not taken one wrong step in the whole plan of his infinite government. There are various parts of the heathen world where the gospel has never yet been, and the Jews have never yet been converted as a nation. But you will find the calling of the Jews and the fullness of the Gentiles plainly foretold in the 11th chapter to the Romans. Posterity shall see this glorious event in some happy future period. How far it is from us, I will not determine. Though upon some grounds, I apprehend it is not very remote. I shall live and die in the unshaken belief that our guilty world shall yet see glorious days. Yes, my brethren, this despised gospel that has so little effect in our age and country shall yet shine like lightning or like the sun through all the dark regions of the earth. It shall triumph over all those dangerous errors that have infected the Christian church. The scheme of providence is not yet completed, and much remains to be accomplished of what God has spoken by his prophets to ripen the world for the universal judgment. But when all these things are finished, then proclamation shall be made through all nature that time shall be no more. Then the supreme judge, the same Jesus that ascended the cross, will ascend the throne and review the affairs of time. Then will he put an end to the present course of nature and the present form of administration. Then shall heaven and hell be filled with their respective inhabitants. Then will time close and eternity run on in one uniform tenor without end. But the kingdom of Christ, though altered in its situation and form of government, will not then come to its conclusion. His kingdom is strictly the kingdom of heaven, and at the end of this world, his subjects will only be removed from these lower regions into a more glorious country, where they and their king shall live together forever in the most endearing intimacy, where the noise and commotions of this restless world, the revolutions and perturbations of kingdoms, the terrors of war and persecution shall no longer reach them. But all will be perfect peace, love, and happiness through immeasurable duration. This is the last and most illustrious state of the kingdom of Christ, now so small and weak in appearance. This is the final grand result of his administration, and it will appear to admiring worlds wisely planned, gloriously executed, and perfectly finished. What conqueror ever erected such a kingdom? What subjects so completely, so lastingly happy as those of the blessed Jesus? From a book called Political Sermons of the American Founding Era. That particular sermon, again, by Samuel Davies, D-A-V-I-E-S. You might want to look that man up. Sounded really good to me. God bless these words to our hearts. Next time, as you know, we're at present anyway, in the middle of January, alternating between the Revelation study that I've done and, well, it was Spurgeon, and then it was this Free Grace broadcaster. And starting next time in the alternate spot will be a brother called Bounds, E. M. Bounds, Edward McKendry Bounds. I'll tell you about him next time around, and we'll read one of his chapters of one of his wonderful books on prayer. You need to study about prayer. This is your time. And this is the Hackberry House of Chosun. Lord willing, we will get to talk again real soon. Bye-bye.